Mr. Bowman.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The panel decision on the motion for injunction in this case observed that the government has not at this juncture made an effort to satisfy strict scrutiny, particularly with respect to the least restrictive means requirement in RFRA. That lack of effort persists in the government's brief, where they address the least restrictive means in a paragraph on less than a page, and they make no real effort to rebut the fact that the government is providing and subsidizing contraception and sterilization by the billions all over the country already. That also indicates that we believe the government's insistence on, frankly, the novel interpretation that it would violate the Establishment Clause to allow families in business free exercise of religion, that their insistence on that is because they know they can't satisfy strict scrutiny. Congress said any free exercise of religion where there's a substantial burden, strict scrutiny needs to apply. Now, strict scrutiny might well be passed for all these other laws that the government says are somehow going to be threatened simply by recognizing that any free exercise of religion does mean any free exercise of religion. However, in this case, the government, we believe, knows that this mandate cannot pass strict scrutiny. That's because, first of all, of the massive exemptions in this law. The Supreme Court said in the Lukumi case that a law cannot be regarded as protecting an interest of the highest order when it leaves appreciable damage to that supposedly vital interest unprohibited. In this case, the government has, by its own numbers, showed that around 100 million Americans, as far out as the numbers depict, will not be subject to this mandate by the government's own choosing under the grandfathering exclusion. Moreover, the structure of the Affordable Care Act requires that those grandfather plans do a variety of things that the Affordable Care Act thinks are really important, like covering children up to age 26, not allowing lifetime limits on certain procedures. These are all in the same section of the Affordable Care Act as the Preventive Services Mandate, 2709 through 2714, and that area. But Congress decided that this mandate is not important enough to impose on this massive swath of plans. That decision by Congress, by definition, means that this mandate is not an interest of the highest order.
Well, isn't the government's position, Mr. Bowman, that that grandfathering is those involved in the grandfathered policies are declining number, and that eventually coverage will reach those that do not have it today?
The government says that and provides no evidence for it. The strict scrutiny analysis is the government's burden to carry, and it is a steep one. The government's own numbers show, as far out as anybody has predicted, that there are going to be about a third of the country in these plans. The government is content to leave those women without the interests that it claims are supposedly compelling. And the government's own regulations declare those plans have a, quote, right, and they say it many times, a right to keep those that status. They can even increase cost to employees within certain limits every year to maintain that grandfather status.
Speaking of the plans, who handles the claims process for the Grote Industries health plan? Is there a third-party claims administrator?
Yes.
Doesn't that interpose yet an additional wall of separation between the Grotes and the potential use of contraceptive services by their employees?
No, that person is just processing paperwork. The Grote family owns 100% of their business. They've run their business for over 85 years. They've run it according to the complaint, which is undisputed, pursuant to their Catholic beliefs, and that includes with respect to this health plan. And what the Supreme Court decided in the Thomas versus Review Board case, that it really is none of the court's business to decide that there's attenuation or separation between what a believer claims he objects to and what the government is forcing him to do.
Well, Thomas, I'd like to take you here, please. Thank you. Because One theme in your briefs, and those of some of the amici, is that it is illogical to distinguish between a not-for-profit organization with a primarily religious mission and a for-profit secular corporation for purposes of recognizing a religious interest that is burdened. I would really appreciate if you could expand on why you think that distinction is arbitrary, given that statutes like Title VII, for example, draw that very type of distinction.
Because when Congress passed RFRA and it did not draw that distinction, it knew very well that it had previously drawn it. It knew it could have drawn that distinction, and it chose not to. The D.C. Circuit indicated in the Muskegee case, 851 F. 2nd, 1439, that where the words of a later statute differ from those of a previous one on the same or related subject, the Congress must have intended them to have a different meaning. So when RFRA protects any exercise of religion for a person, which the Dictionary Act says is corporations, and Title VII, 30 years earlier, only protected religious corporations in a more narrow sense that the Ninth Circuit considered in the World Vision case, which is on a different statute, then what the court needs to presume is that Congress meant any exercise of religion means any exercise. Now, to answer your question, Judge Rovner, the Supreme Court explained in the Bilotti case why the question of the formality of the corporate status is the wrong question to ask. When someone raises a fundamental right claim, a free exercise claim, which in RFRA is the codifies what free exercise means in the First Amendment, the Supreme Court in Bilotti said you don't ask who the person is, you ask what they're doing. And yeah, is what they're doing what the Constitution protects?
I mean, you suggested in the briefs that the Groats are exercising their religious beliefs through their company. But you and some of the amici also say that it's not a court's job in any way to question or look behind that assertion, regardless of whether or not the company has an overtly a religious purpose or not. So if Walmart or Apple Computer or Juicy Couture comes into court and says, this requirement is inconsistent with our religious beliefs. Is it your view that we are obliged to accept that assertion from those companies at face value?
The court can inquire into sincerity, which is not in dispute here, and that is an inquiry that's proper for the court. So whether it's a fraudulent belief or whether it's sincere, whether it's factually true that those companies actually have that belief and are implementing it, that's an inquiry. But none of that is in dispute here. What can't be done is for the court to say, well, really what the people object to is morally separate from what the government is forcing them to do. That's a theological inquiry that the court in Thomas said is illicit. What the court in Thomas said was that if Thomas drew a line, I don't want to work at a tank factory, but I would work at a sheet metal factory that sent the metal to the tank factory. And the government said, see, you're facilitating evil regardless. You're helping war. And the court said, that's none of our business. Thomas drew a line, and it is not for us to say it was unreasonable. Courts should not undertake to dissect religious beliefs. Now, in terms of whether the corporate...
Ms. Bowman, now, I don't want to go too far back in the 70s. I think there was a rock star who wanted to withhold a portion of concert receipts because they would go to the General Treasury and advance our military activities abroad. Now, I want to make sure I understand your argument about, you know, we talked about the tanks and that. Could a corporation such as we have here, religious belief, just opposed any sort of military involvement? It's a religious matter. It's a pacifist. Recognized belief.
They could.
Withhold a portion of the tax that they believe goes to DOD?
Well, the question is, would they win? There's two questions. Are they exercising religion when they do it?
Right.
And if they are, will they eventually win the case? Two separate questions. On the first question, all the case law says, yeah, they're exercising religion. The Amish employer was for profit.
Right.
He was exercising religion. He had a sufficient rendered under the First Amendment. The United States Supreme Court went on to the scrutiny analysis, which I would say wasn't actually strict scrutiny. It was a balancing test. All we're asking for here, and all the government is resisting, is that the court get to strict scrutiny. None of the cases that have ruled the government's other way that I'm aware of in these mandate cases have done so on the basis that the mandate can somehow pass strict scrutiny or that the government has met its burden there, which is a very heavy burden, as we described in the Brown versus Entertainment case. So we would say, yeah, if a business said we don't want to do business in South Africa during the years of apartheid, because of our religious conviction.
Well, how about supporting our embassy there during that time? I guess I'm trying to see how attenuated, if at all, one can approach this issue on religious grounds.
The court is allowed to ask, okay, what does the person actually object to here? Now, here, there's a unity between what the Grodies object to doing, providing the coverage, and what the mandate forces them to do, provide the coverage. So there's no attenuation there, and the court and Thomas.
I appreciate how close it is. I'm just trying to see whether where we are beyond perhaps the confines of this case.
Yes. All we're saying is that when a family makes that decision in their closely held business, they're exercising religion. The court could go on and say their business is also exercising religion. We think that's the right answer. The Ninth Circuit decided you don't need to decide that question, and I think that they were right about that. But that doesn't end the inquiry. If it's just some other law, I think it's actually an insult to all these other laws the government refers to say that they would fail strict scrutiny just because this mandate would. This mandate really doesn't even come close to the government being able to show that it passes strict scrutiny. That's not true under the other laws that they cite.
So now, your argument draws the line, as in the prior case, at closely held corporations?
We think that this court need not go beyond those facts. I would say in some of the questions that were asked before, well, what if it was 51%, mm-hmm. or what if it was just the manager? I think in that question you actually have a state action problem. So if it's just the manager of the company who objects to doing it, but the decision makers of the company say we want you to do it, then it's not really the government's fault that the manager has to do it, right? It's the board's fault. It's the shareholder's fault. So I think if 51% of a publicly held traded company decided that on conviction they were going to support the environment or they were going to do some other thing, I think that company would probably, if we had to get there, we'd probably say, yeah, they're probably exercising that conviction. If it happened to be a religious conviction, they're probably exercising it. That's not the case here. Here we have a much closer unity. And I think it's important to note that when the government says, oh, well, this is just going to blur the distinctions between corporations and their owners, that's not true at all, because there's not actually that distinction in law. In a closely held corporation, in an S corporation, the taxes pass through profits and losses to the owners. In family law for an S corporation, when the court's deciding on alimony and child support, they actually look through to the corporation and say, well, this is really your money. So
corporation is a distinct legal entity.
For some purposes.
And a real legal entity.
It is, absolutely, for some purposes, but not for moral purposes. So just because a corporation has some limited legal liability doesn't mean that it limits moral liability. It doesn't. So the mere fact that there's a distinct entity for liability purposes doesn't mean that that means that the family has no moral and religious claim to what the government is forcing them to do, to what the government is pressuring them to do.
What I'm trying to figure out is why it's improper to draw a distinction between obligations that are placed on the Grodes personally and money that comes directly out of their pocket, and obligations that are placed on Grode Industries and checks that are written by the company and not the Grodes. Because hasn't the law always recognized such a distinction when we are talking about a corporation? versus the owners of the corporation? Because what you said, well, the reason I'm thinking about that is because you said in your reply brief that it's outrageous to mention the commingling of corporate and personal funds when we're discussing the Groats assertion that their religious rights are implicated by the use of company funds to pay for contraceptive coverage. I mean, if you wonder why, where that's coming from.
Yes. Yes, and I see my time is up.
No,
I'd be glad to answer your question.
Yes, you may respond.
There are really two reasons. The first reason is that the fact that there's a separation between the company and the owners for some purposes doesn't mean for all purposes, particularly moral purposes. And in this situation, the separation as a legal matter isn't really all that separate. Indiana law says a corporation can pursue any lawful purpose, and the Grody articles do exactly say that, and religion is lawful in Indiana. So they're pursuing a lawful purpose. But moreover, the Supreme Court said that, and this circuit has said, what a substantial burden is you can either require someone to do something or you can pressure them so that they have to choose. And there's no doubt here that the Grody family is being forced to choose, either suffer these penalties, and again, the money isn't all that distinct as a close S corporation. They can also be the company can be sued to force them to do it. There's nobody else to implement this mandate but them. And that choice that they're being forced to make to forfeit the benefits of being doing business at all, they'd be forced out of business entirely. They wouldn't be able to own any business according to their morality. That's a substantial burden.
Mr. Bowman, if an individual like Cyril and Jane, excuse me, that's the court case. I mean, if the children of the, is it Grote or Grote? How do you
Grody, yeah.
Grote, yeah. If the children of individuals such as the Grotes, presumably of the same faith, inherit the business, does there have to be a reexamination whether they hold, I mean, when it's closely held as it is here, 100%, and now it becomes 100%, let's say, with children, does that be a re-examination of some sort, or is it just what would happen there? Would the government check again to see whether the belief is still as strong or as committed?
Possibly. I'm just
thinking where we go with these kinds of issues. I mean,
yes. Corporate policy. Indiana law decides how corporate policy is set. In this company, there's no question that this is the policy.
Yeah, and no, so, I know that's not an issue here.
And these particular children are as co-plaintiffs in the case have agreed that they're
thinking about their children.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And their children might have different beliefs, so that could people are allowed to have different beliefs.
No. I understand that. I'm just seeing whether once the corporate exemption is in place, and it let's say as may often be the case, it just stays within families. Whether that's just a presumption that it's intact. Because the beliefs were initially established by parents or grandparents.
I think there could be an inquiry. Do you guys still hold this belief? I think that's fair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Ms. Klein? Klein, could you spend a little time on this least restrictive issue?
Yes, I'd like to address both attenuation and strict scrutiny.
I don't mean to limit you. I want to get to that because the suggestion is that the government didn't spend too much time on that.
Yes, and I will, if the court doesn't mind, I'll just focus first on the attenuation issue and then second on strict scrutiny. The argument, as I hear it, is that it's none of the court's business to say this line is too attenuated. We know, Your Honor mentioned the tax cases. We know that's not the case. At least when you're talking about payment of taxes into the general treasury, the Supreme Court has said the interests of a taxpayer in the monies in the federal treasury are too indeterminable, remote, uncertain, and indirect to furnish a basis for an appeal to the preventive powers of the court.
That's standing doctrine.
Exactly. And
is it the government's position that there's no standing here?
Well, yes, with respect to the individuals, but this is, it relates to attenuation. And
you didn't argue that.
Well, we argued it in the supplemental briefs. We hope the courts are looking at those briefs, particularly because Article III standing, of course, has to be addressed.
So the government's position is that the individual plaintiffs lack standing?
Correct.
The corporate plaintiff has standing.
But lacks a claim on the merits.
And what's the government's position on the Tax Injunction Act?
The Anti-Injunction Act, yeah, for very specific reasons that we've set out. It's somewhat technical. We do not believe it's a bar.
Okay.
Okay. But so just going on from this point, it's well settled that the collection of tax revenues for expenditures that offend the religious beliefs of individual taxpayers does not violate the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. The argument
that's
here,
again, a standing argument. That's not an argument about substantial burden.
Well, it's a holding that there is no cognizable burden, so it would follow that there is no substantial burden if there's no burden at all.
Well, then how do you explain the Amish case, the Social Security case?
Well, these cases are actually citing it. There are a number of strands of reasoning in Lee, and I want to also focus on Lee when we're talking about strict scrutiny. But just before I leave, to be clear, as I understand the plaintiff's position, say in the first case where there are 70 union employees who get their group health coverage through the union plan, including contraceptive coverage, though the shareholders, they haven't chosen to object to that, on their theory, if they said, we can't recognize a union because that is facilitating contraceptive coverage for our employees, that a court would have to accept it, would have to treat it as a substantial burden, and then would have to subject to strict scrutiny the NLRA provisions. So just to go back to the point that I made earlier, we do not believe that's a tenable interpretation of RFRA, and that the argument that through RFRA, Congress allowed for-profit corporations to demand exemptions from payroll taxes, OSHA, Title VII non-discrimination provisions, and this is explicitly the argument that's in the briefs, that is not plausible on its face, and if the court wants additional legislative history support, it's repudiated in the Senate report to RFRA, which said other areas of law unaffected with specific reference to the Title VII religious accommodation. Going on to strict scrutiny, I think it is important to contrast this case with Lee, where, of course, this was just an individual Amish employer, and he lost. And what he had said was, my religion requires me to provide for my own needy. So my handful of Amish employees, they were on the farm, I both cannot and should not have to make the payroll taxes that would support them if they were unemployed or in pension benefits.
Fine. With respect, wouldn't you say that the Amish objection, sincere in their belief of taking care of the elderly as a religious precept, may not match up with the religious precept that's at issue in this case? Not to get into sincerity, but into what I would think some might argue is the depth of a particular religious belief. I'm not grading them, but I mean, withholding the tax on the withholding arguably is of a different order than we have here, is it not?
With respect, I disagree. I think that it's more attenuated here because the argument there was, I'm being required to pay into this segregated fund for unemployment benefits. My religion, and this was actually credible, the Amish do provide for their own needy. So, like, you could have said, oh, come on, why can't you just just exempt this Amish employer because we don't have to worry about the problem. And so he said, I will provide if my, farmhand.
Well, that's the argument there is you're overtaxing me. Right?
Yes, and
I don't think the argument in these cases is about overtaxing.
Well, but the argument here, so there it was just any contribution to the Social Security tax fund, that's inconsistent with my religion because I have to provide.
I appreciate that as a statement of fact and generally held, but I'm just suggesting that, and you say you disagree, then you disagree, and that may be the case.
Explain why it's more attenuated here, this is, I don't want to contribute to a general pool of money, health insurance coverage. That's what it is. That then the recipient, the employee, or his spouse, might use to obtain, through independent decisions by the employee and her physician, health services to which I object. So we have much greater attenuation than in Lee, where the argument was, I can't pay into health insurance. My religion does not pay into, Social Security, so unemployment and pension benefits, and my religion does not allow it.
The rationale of Lee was not attenuation. It was about the importance of the Social Security tax system. Well, that's why the claimant in that case lost. It had nothing to do with attenuated burdens or de minimis burdens or indirect burdens. It had to do with not failing strict scrutiny because of the importance of the program.
No, that's correct. And the attenuation point I was making was the different point about how the Supreme Court and the Courts of Appeals have said your interests in a general pool of money are too remote. That's too attenuated.
That's a standing issue. That's not a merits issue. And we're
well, Your Honor, if there's no standing, there's clearly no substantial.
The corporation has standing. You're conceding that.
The corporation doesn't have any burden on its religious exercise because Congress didn't give for-profit.
That's a separate question that we discussed just a few minutes ago at length. So now let's focus on the substantial burden, the substantiality of the burden on the corporation to violate its creed, essentially, as it's been established by its owners by providing this mandated coverage. Why are we second-guessing that?
Well, again, because the logic of their argument is, we'll use the union example again. I, as a corporate officer, controlling shareholder, I can't allow my employees to unionize because then they will get contraceptive coverage.
The Title VII example is just—it's just not analogous here.
What we're talking about is
RFRA, which grants a very broad protection for free exercise rights, and if Congress had wanted to narrow it in the way that it narrowed the exemption for religious organizations in Title VII, it could easily have done so, and it didn't.
And I know I've been clear on this, but this is where we absolutely disagree.
Okay, I understand that. I want to talk about whether this is a substantial burden. You concede my point for the moment and engage with me on the question of the substantiality of this burden. How is this not a substantial burden? Accepting that this mandate violates the creed of these individuals and the mission of their corporation as it's been established by them, which is not just to make money, but also to abide by Catholic social teaching in an ethical way as the Church teaches. How is not imposing this mandate, which is in direct conflict with the contraception rules of the Church, and backing it up with penalties of hundreds of thousands of dollars, not a substantial burden?
Because that is an argument that any burden articulated has to be accepted. Anything different from that articulated burden has to be substantial.
And that's what the Supreme Court's case law in the free exercise context calls for. We don't second guess that. We move to the merits.
When Congress enacted RFRA, the first version said any burden. There was then an amendment that added the word substantial, and that was in order to ensure that any burden wouldn't be the basis for moving to strict scrutiny. So that is not what Congress did when it enacted RFRA. And the idea that there could be no degree of attenuation, so imagine a prisoner who said, not that I need halal food or kosher diet, but my cellmate, too, because I can't be here sitting idly by my religion, I would have to intervene. That too has to be then subjected to strict scrutiny. That's never been the case, and it's not a plausible interpretation of RFRA.
But you have to engage with the religious exercise right that's being asserted here, and the government really hasn't done that yet, at least so far as I've seen the briefing. And the right that's being exercised here is that it's not the third-party employee's decision to use contraception that's really the focus. It's the employer's facilitation of that by paying for it.
No,
that is the violation of the Church doctrine.
No, I understand.
And that's not attenuated at all. That is a direct conflict. So the government's argument that this is so attenuated because it's only a third party making this decision and all the employer is doing is contributing to a pool of money misses the whole point of the religious liberty claim here, which is that buying this coverage, paying for it, violates Catholic social teaching.
But with respect,
That would mean that any claim articulated can establish a substantial burden. If they say, I can't allow my employees to unionize, the corporation, I'll posit that for purposes of this discussion, it's the corporation, I am imputed with the religious beliefs of my shareholders, I can't allow my employees to unionize because then they can get contraceptive coverage through the union plan, that we would go to strict scrutiny. And that is not, there is nothing to suggest that's what Congress was doing, and to the extent Congress addressed the issue, it said other areas of law are unaffected.
So if we get to the question of whether the mandate is the least restrictive means of ensuring access to contraceptive care, is it relevant that the government could set up some form of publicly funded coverage for contraceptive care?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for allowing me to get to that point. The same argument could have been made in Lee. Don't fund the Social Security system through a payroll tax on employers. Just fund it out of general revenues. That's never been an argument that has been treated as a basis for saying there's not a least restrictive means. There is no precedent for saying the government should finance, whether it's, you can imagine all sorts of health services, immunizations. There are individuals who personally won't have their children immunized for religious reasons. It doesn't mean the government has to pay.
You hearken back to that case, but is that anything comparable to where we have here is such a substantial exemption of a population under the existing law?
Well, if Your Honor is referring to the grandfathering provisions?
No, not just grandfathering. The whole religious exemption.
Oh, okay.
Gives millions of individuals a different status.
But again, the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the government can accommodate religious organizations and doesn't therefore have to extend those accommodations to what we regard as for-profit secular corporations, but to others, even in Lee itself.
I'm not suggesting that the Congress acted in any unconstitutional fashion. I'm just saying, recognizing that doesn't that...
The Catholic Social Services case is exactly right, that if you were to conclude, because in here it's the agencies, they've made an effort to address religious concerns that are raised by nonprofit, either churches themselves or hospitals, that undermines the idea that there's a compelling interest.
But doesn't that speak to the possibility of less, if you can make that accommodation?
Well, that would always
be. Wouldn't that speak to the ability of the government to, or the Congress to on the least restrictive? In other words, how much
that was the argument in Lee. So there really was an exemption in Lee for self-employed Amish. And the farmer in Lee said, you should exempt me too. I'm not materially that different. I'm going to provide for my own needy. And that was the argument that was rejected by the Supreme Court. You could always say, a exemption for certain religious practices means that you could just expand it to lots of others, but that's never been the basis for saying that you have less restrictive means.
Right, but then again, on that case, it was a decision based on the application of strict scrutiny, and the court said that the Social Security program survived strict scrutiny. It wasn't a decision based on a lack of substantiality of the burden.
Well,
and here,
I took the question to be about strict scrutiny, about least restrictive means. So, I agree with Your Honor that Lee was applying strict scrutiny.
The government's position on the exemption for religious nonprofits suggests that the government acknowledges the substantiality of this burden.
No, to be clear, and I think this has been made clear by the departments, they are not suggesting these exemptions are mandated by RFRA. And the Supreme Court has said you can do things that aren't required either by the Free Exercise Clause or by RFRA without raising Establishment Clause concerns. But we do not concede
so
that there is a substantial burden.
So it's a matter of just bureaucratic grace.
Well, I would say a long tradition of accommodation of religious institutions the departments have explicitly drawn upon the same line that Congress drew in Title VII, the NLRA, the ADA, and other areas of federal law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. Mr. Bowman, did Ms. Bowman have any more time? Ms. Bowman, we, as we did in the earlier case, asked several questions. You may have an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I hope not to use it. On the standing issues, we do stand by our motion to strike. Not only did the government not argue the issue, it conceded individual standing on page 28 of their brief, where they say for the individuals, an issue not standing of the individuals not presented here because the Grotys are plaintiffs and therefore can assert their own rights. Moreover, the Grotys are not mere shareholders, so the shareholder standing case law is not applicable. But even if it was, it's a prudential doctrine. And what the Supreme Court said in the Havens Realty Corp. case, 455 U.S. at 372, is that courts lack the authority to create prudential barriers to standing when Congress intended standing to extend to the full limits of Article III. RFRA explicitly says that standing extends to the full limits of Article III and Section BB1 Part C. In other words, the government waived the argument. And I would simply say that substantial is in the burden analysis, but it's a substantial burden, not a substantial belief. The substantiality just measures how heavy is this government penalty. Here, the government penalty is direct. You can't do this, and if you do, we're going to sue you and we're going to fine you. That's substantial by any definition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Thank you again, Ms. Klein. The case is taken under...